we consider all of the tongue lashing that America is giving the Russians over their non-activity in the Ukraine, it is interesting to note that there was also a news item on the International Space Station. America has no capacity to take an astronaut to the space station or to bring them back home. America no longer has a manned space program. And so guess which country America is 100% dependent upon to bring the current occupants of the International Space Station back to Earth? If you were to guess the Russians, you would be right. Now, as it relates to the Ukraine, the United States is tongue-lashing Russia, saying that the Russians are escalating the violence in the eastern part of Ukraine, which really is Little Russia. And yet there's no evidence of that whatsoever. There's not a single Russian operative that has been found. Not a single Russian piece of military equipment that has been deployed. And there are journalists all over those 12 cities in the east. And there's not a single trace of evidence. The United States has the largest spy network in the world and can't make public a single communication, a single troop movement, a single act which would hold Russia accountable for the defenses that have been put around the 12 cities in the east. And yet, hypocritically, the United States not only is putting hundreds of its troops on the ground in countries that border Russia and celebrating the maneuvering of those troops to those places, saying it's doing so to show its support for the Ukraine. But America actually told the Ukrainians that it was behind them, that it was supporting them, that it was urging them to use their military to go after the protesters and the civilians that want no part of the Ukraine in the east. America told the Ukrainian acting government to use its weaponry, and America would pay for it, to go attack the civilians in those 12 cities that are saying they want no part of the Ukraine in the West. What do you think about those apples, Glenn?
Well, I think it's pretty good gas station that can put rockets and space stations up in the air.
That's one thing. Yeah, have you ever heard of a gas station having a nuclear arsenal on international guided ballistic missiles?
Yeah, 13 time zones, wide. That's a big gas station. The I'm looking at the Ukrainian stuff here, and I tell you, I look at the leaders and the presidents and the prime ministers and the, foreign ministers and stuff like that. And I think, I look at McCain and our people, and then I think of Putin and Lavrov, and they are the two, adults in the room as far as I'm concerned. They're the two most mature, most statesmanlike people, and yet this total weasel, this product of nepotism, McCain, presumes to put them down.
Yeah, you mentioned product of nepotism. John McCain was allowed into the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis because his daddy was an admiral. And he did everything to dishonor himself and the Naval Academy while he was there. And he did everything to dishonor himself and the Navy during his obligatory service. And his only contribution is that he was imprisoned in the Hanoi Hilton for a prolonged period of time. He is a product.
During which he sold out his compadres. you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not sure about that one.
I think from what I can tell, he was a pretty good prisoner. But he is certainly a product of nepotism. There's no question about that. He did things in military aircraft that are as childish as calling Russia a gas station run by the mafia. The reality is right now the United States has got its vice president saying that we're standing, not only standing with the Ukrainians, but shoveling money at the Ukrainians while telling the Ukrainians to use their military to go after civilian protests in the East. And so while we're tongue-lashing Russia, saying that Russia is the one that is the aggressor here, the United States is in Kiev telling the acting government to go use its military to escalate this. I mean, we are the poster child now in the world for hypocrisy.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, while they have Yatsenyuk at the helm, you know, doing the, you know, all of the TV work and everything, I have to think there are more nasty influences that are really calling more of the shots in the background, like Tymoshenko. She's the one who got caught on her cell phone saying that she'd like to nuke the Russians. So if they're going to give them weapons, they could just give them nice, you know, low yield, dialable yield, neutron nukes, you know, and then, you know, let her play with those for a while.
Yeah, here's the two people that were killed in the eastern Ukraine. We've got no idea who killed them. And yet the puppet head of the Ukrainian government says these crimes are being committed with the full support and connivance of the Russian Federation. You know, show some evidence. You make a statement like that? Show some evidence. The United States spends some $100 billion a year on its spy apparatus. Show some evidence. You know, we're over there in the Ukraine shoveling money at them. Show some evidence. There isn't any. And, you know, I don't know if one of the pro or the ethnic Russian groups in the East tortured and killed a man and killed another. I don't know. You know, it could well have been that they thought that was the person that gave the orders to fire upon them. And was holding them accountable. I don't know. And I don't want to make it sound like the Russians who are the ethnic Russians, not the Russian Federation, but the ethnic Russians in the East who are trying to disassociate from Kiev are good guys. I don't want to infer that. But I want to communicate that there is really very little difference between those Russian ethnic Russian speakers in the East and the thugs in Kiev that occupied government buildings. There really is very little difference between them. And so for the United States to say that we side with one and we want the one that we side with to go use its military that we're going to pay for to attack the other is saying that we're the instigators in what could blow up to become a world war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's grotesquely inappropriate.
Right. Oh, absolutely. But you know what? I don't think, it seems to me, I don't know, the Ukraine is so obviously unviable. And that's what I keep, that seems to be a word that seems to be emerging.
It is unviable.
It is unviable. And so it's almost like Putin can sit back at the chessboard and let the opposition study its options and then begin to thrash because they have no viable moves. Even with weapons, they're only going to end up with chaos, more chaos.
The consequence, that's why America, describing America says we never recognize the consequence of our actions. The consequence of telling the Ukrainian government to use its military to attack the protesters in the East is that it's going to inflame a civil war in that country. That's what it's going to bring. It's not going to bring peace. It's not going to bring stability. It's going to inflame a civil war in that country. And when that occurs, then what is Russia going to do? Russia will eventually have to respond. And when Russia responds, what's America going to do? We're going to send troops? We're going to send warplanes? Are we going to start bombing the Russians? I mean, how can this lead to anything that is beneficial? And as you say, the brief history of a Ukrainian state, 20 years, shows one thing, that it's wholly and completely unsustainable, that there isn't any scenario where you can have a viable Ukrainian state independent. They're dependent on Russian gas, wholly dependent on Russian gas. They are dependent upon Western or Russian gratuity in terms of funding. They are. It's just the and there is no way that giving them billions of dollars resolves their problem. They chew it up, spit it out, and then right have their hand back out and say, "I need more." It's not viable, and so it never should have been created as a state. Moreover, even the failed states that have emerged from the disintegration of Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and their little ethnic tribal regions, the only ones that have some semblance of peace are the ones where they only have one ethnic group, but they have no economic viability. And the ones that have multiple ethnic groups, they have no social stability. You think of Macedonia right now, and it's being torn apart by the Muslim and Christian aspects of the country that were cobbled together. In the Ukraine, where you had the East and the South that were, you know, ethnic Russians, now disassociated from Russia and associated with this group of Ukrainians that wanted to be more aligned with Europe. It had no chance under the way it was drawn to succeed. Now, none of the three regions have any chance of succeeding economically. But in terms of just social chaos, the cobbled together nature of that state had no chance of succeeding. So why involve oneself in a scenario that has no chance of success? There is no viable outcome here where you end up with a free and economically, socially stable, viable country. It's absolutely impossible. And so why wage, take the world to the doorstep of world war over such a situation? It's a lose game. Just curious, I looked at the crew for the International Space Station. It's currently Expedition 39 that is up there. Among the six dudes that are currently occupying the International Space Station, one is Japanese, two are American, and three are Russians. So that's we are putting the Americans and Japanese at great risk with our blathering. I guess, okay, that John McCain can call Vladimir and say, you know, we need your gas station to service our space station. Would you send a Soyuz capsule up there to bring our boys back home? Because we can't do it.
Well, at least for the moment, Perry has ordered the U.S. astronauts not to speak to the Russians.
Okay, that's good. Or maybe he's told them that they to tell the Russians, tongue-lash them and say that you have created a hostile atmosphere up
working
there.
Working Yes.
It's a hostile working
environment. This is your side of the castle. This is our side of the castle. Don't you come over here.
And I don't want any provocations from your side of the capsule. I'm going to report all provocations. This is the most recent story out of the Ukraine. It says this is a quote from the Ukraine first deputy prime minister. Why not just call him the acting first deputy prime minister? This is Yarema. He says security forces are working on the liquidation of illegal armed groups in the east. The liquidation. Does that sound, well, if you were someone who was a political protester, which is what those folks are in the East, how would you view someone who is calling for your liquidation, would you think that perhaps that you would have to defend yourself against them if they're calling for your liquidation? What would be the proper response?
There's some bad maybe going to happen. You're going to get liquidated, you know?
So the mafia, I guess, is in Kiev, because it's Kiev that's calling for the liquidation of its citizens. It says the corresponding activities will be carried out in the near future. You will see the results, which sounds very mafioso to me as well. The Kiev government, which, by the way, is an acting government, which took power after the Moscow-backed President Viktor Yanukovych. By the way, Yanukovych was not Moscow-backed. That is a myth. He played Moscow against the European community. And he wanted to side with the European community. In fact, his first three financing rounds were all with the European community through the International Bank. But the problem was that the Ukraine reneged on all three of those, welched on the deals, and he couldn't get a favorable fourth deal with the EU. So he turned to Russia and say, we need $15 billion, and we need it now. Are your terms better than the terms that we can get from the West? And Russia gave them better terms. And that's the reason why he sided with the Russians as it relates to finance. So this picturing him as the Moscow-backed candidate, Moscow couldn't stand him. And Moscow... and it never has embraced him. They don't like him. They think he's a scum. He is wholly undependable. Anyway, it goes on to say that that Yanukovych fled the capital over over whether to strengthen ties with Europe. He fled the capital because the thugs that occupied the government buildings in Kiev threatened to kill him. That's why he left the capital. He appeared to have been emboldened by Tuesday's visit. This is now the Kiev acting government of Vice President Biden. He brought a package of aid and urged Russia to curb separatist militias in the east, even though Russia is not using them. It's not deploying them. This is the statement from the acting government. We have obtained the support of the United States, that they will not leave us alone with the aggressor. We hope that in the event of Russian aggression, this help will be more substantive. He said specifically that the United States had authorized their use of their military and said that the United States is paying for their use of their military to attack Ukrainian citizens in the east. And yet we're telling the Russians that they're being provocative?
Nudge, wink, wink, nudge said.
Oh, you know, and the fact is that the United States was behind the unrest in Kiev in the first place. You know, you don't see Putin in any one of these 12 cities in the east. You don't see his Secretary of State in any one of these eastern cities. You don't see the Secret Service of the Russians in any one of these eastern cities. And yet we've got our CIA in Kiev, our Vice President in Kiev, and our Secretary of State in Kiev. Who's being provocative? Earlier this week, the President of the United States ordered another drone attack in Yemen. It's about 600 or 700 now that he has launched in Yemen. And he did so because there was an internet film of a bunch of Muslims, clerics, and jihadi types in Yemen saying that they were going to go after and break the cross, which they attributed to America. So from their perspective, America is a Christian nation. It's the carrier of the cross. Islam is opposed to Christianity, so that as good Muslims, they must... attack America. Now, this is what's called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. It's not an Al-Qaeda franchise. It had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden have spoken against the organization, and they have shown that they have no affinity whatsoever with it. They just an American Islamic cleric, decided to use the name thinking that it would garner him attention. There is no indication they've ever had more than about 200 members, most of which the United States has killed, and that and we killed them and they repopulate. That's about the history of them. They've had two unsuccessful attempts to attack America. We only know of two, both of which were unsuccessful. So there is not an indication that they have actually killed an American, although Americans have killed many of them. The first attack was the underwear bomber who burned his own britches, which is unfortunate for him because the only reward for being a jihadist is the multiple of virgins, and so he scorched the part of his anatomy, I guess, that could have been used successfully to enjoy the fruits of his victory. And the second is that they cleverly created a bomb in a Hewlett-Packard printer that they bought at an Office Depot and shipped through UPS, where they replaced the ink in the ink cartridges and made it a bomb. And, you know, it'd be a low-grade bomb because not a lot of explosives going to fit into the ink cartridges. But they then mailed that to two synagogues in America, but it never made it to America. It was somebody trying to say, come on, you're going to ship a Hewlett-Packard printer from Yemen into the United States, where they're a dime a dozen in the United States, where the freight is going to be many times more than the cost of the printer. And, oh, by the way, the address is somewhat suspicious. Both addresses for both printers were U.S. synagogues. So neither one of them made it very far. And that's the extent of their carnage. And yet the United States sends drones to kill them, I guess because we can. So here's the most recent summation of a story. And this last one, this video was irritating and embarrassing to the administration because here's a bunch of Islamic clerics and jihadis talking about how they're going to break the cross. And so America said, all right, yeah, you're going to make a film. We're going to show you how we react to a film. So the popular resentment, this is a story, toward the U.S. drone campaign that has long festered in Pakistan is beginning to emerge in Yemen. On April 23rd of 2013, the Senate Judiciary Committee held its first public hearing dedicated to the legal issues, they should really say illegal issues, surrounding the U.S. drone campaign. One of the six who testified was Ferreira al-Muslami, a young Yemeni activist who spent his high school days in the United States. Al-Muslami told the committee that a drone strike had targeted his village of Waseb just 6 days earlier. Quote, what the Muslims had previously failed to achieve in my village, al-Muslami told the senators, one drone strike accomplished in an instant. Now there is an intense anger and growing hatred of America. You can't win a religious war with bullets and bombs, not even with drones. For every individual you kill, you manufacture 1,000 more that hate you. It's the lesson we did not learn in Vietnam. It is the lesson of Yemen and Pakistan, where America is despised by the population at large because of our ruthless and deadly behavior. When you send drones to kill a score of men, all you do is you cause the entire community in which those score of men lived to hate you, to be willing to sacrifice their lives to kill you. It is unbelievably counterproductive. It's like our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. We didn't endear either community to America. We caused both to hate us all the more. Speaking of them hating us and also one another, Iraq, which had almost no terrorist activity in it before the American invasion, is now the world's hotbed for terrorist activity. Suicide bombers and other attacks across Iraq killed at least 30 people and wounded over 70 more on Monday of this week. It's the latest uptick in violence in the country. Over the past year, this terrorist violence has surged in Iraq to levels that had been previously unseen since 2008 in the midst of the American invasion. The increase in deadly shootings and bombings has become a reality because of the Shiite-led government and the imposition that of no autonomy, no influence, no opportunity for a civil life that has been imposed upon the Sunnis. So the Shiite government that America facilitated, the one that is now controlled out of Tehran, is lashing back at the Sunnis, and the Sunnis are trying to kill them. We took a country that was not broken because there was a strong man that kept infighting between Sunnis and Shia to a minimum. And we broke that country apart, giving the country to Iran, where there is now a civil war between Sunnis and Shias. And America is to blame. It's interesting that America, that wants to supply weapons now to the acting government in the Ukraine, the same government same country that supplies weapons indirectly to the Sunni rebels in Syria, now wants to start supplying weapons again to Egypt. You may have heard that in Egypt now there are two people that are going to run for election. You see, there's not a host of candidates as there were previously because 70% of the Islamic population of Egypt no longer has a voice. If you belong to any Islamic organization, you're killed. You're imprisoned. The Muslim Brotherhood and the Salaf parties have both been labeled terrorist organizations, and they are not allowed to participate not only in politics, but they're not even allowed to exist in the country. So there's only two candidates running, which means that there's only perhaps as much as 30% of the population of Egypt that gets a say in the next election. And one is the general that orchestrated the coup that replaced the only popularly elected government in the country's modern history, maybe the country's history ever. And the other now is a communist. So we have a communist against a military dictator. That's the election. And so America said, oh, well, now that we see clear to popular elections in Egypt, let's resume the flow of arms. Precisely what we've said. So you've got the head of a military junta against a communist with three quarters of the population of Egypt not having a candidate or a voice. And we call that democracy, and decide that we're going to send them Apache attack helicopters, the first thing on the agenda. Yep, Apache attack helicopters. What do you think about those apples, Glenn?
Good luck in getting competently trained pilots for them, for certain. But I got to go with the military dictator. In view of what Saddam Hussein did for Iraq, and Muammar Gaddafi, crazy as it was, did for Libya, seems like the smaller countries are having better success with military dictators who are either A, you know, who have to become very pragmatic, or B, develop a grow a conscience such that they actually divert some of their country's wealth and resources to the benefit of the people.
Well, if you look at the Assad regime in Syria, if you looked at Iraq under Saddam Hussein, you'd come to that conclusion. You look at Libya under Muammar Gaddafi. You look at Egypt under Mubarak and now under Sisi. You'd come to the conclusion that the only government that, and I'm going to put works in quotes, in an Islamic country, is a military dictatorship. And it's because they're intolerant of the terrorist expression of fundamentalist Islam. And so you would look at it and say, yeah, that's not democracy. That's a military dictatorship. It's the very thing that, as Americans, we ought to be opposed to. And yet it's the only form of governance that seems to work there, and we seem to want to depose it.
Well, they're Napoleonic. They know that, you know, Napoleon said that, you know, authority and power flows from the barrel of a gun. So a military guy understands that. Anyone who's naive enough to be a political ideologue, you know, is just going to get snowed under in a situation like that.
So while I would agree that that Sisi would be the a better than Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood as it relates to both Egypt and its neighbors, the fact is that that Sisi is a thug. I mean, during the time that he's been empowered, the abuse against women and the abuse against the cops who were responsible for empowering him has been egregious, and he's done nothing to protect either. And so he's just nothing but a general thug. And so while I can appreciate the fact that this general thug is better than Morsi, again, you're dealing with perhaps the lesser of two grotesque evils. I suggest that if that's the choice that that worked there, we ought not be behind it. We ought not be arming it. We ought not be funding it. We ought not be manipulating this. We ought not be siding with either evil. As the United States prepares to send Apache attack helicopters and to open the spigot that pays for 100% of Egypt's military budget, it should be noted that the elections, this is from a BBC article, the elections which will be held in Egypt will be performed in a barren, sterile political climate. 3 years after the uprising that overthrew autocrat Hosni Mubarak raised hopes that a democracy was possible in Islam's biggest Arab nation. There will be no Islamist candidate, in contrast to the hotly contested 2012 presidential race, which featured more than a dozen Islamic rivals from across the political spectrum and was won by Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, we'll have a communist against the military junta. The military junta, by the way, controls the media. It controls the government. It controls the police. It controls everything. Who do you think is going to win? I read a news article during the break, Glenn, that is exactly as we would have thought. Russia will respond if its interests in Ukraine are attacked. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said today, drawing a parallel with Georgia in 2008. Speaking to Russian TV on the RT, the Russian channel, Lavrov also accused the United States of running the show in the Ukraine. In a statement, Russia's foreign ministry repeated its call for the Ukraine to withdraw military units from the east. The Ukraine's government faces an armed revolt there by pro-Russian separatists. The Kiev and the West say that Moscow commands its gunmen in the east. Moscow denies this. It is now said, you've got the foreign minister of the Russian Federation telling the truth, that America is running the show in Kiev and is being the belligerent, and that if it continues to do so, Russia will have no choice but to deploy its forces to defend its interests, its citizens, in the east. Why is the United States provoking a war? What's to be gained? What's to be gained? I can see lots to be lost. I can't see anything to be gained. If this is like the old Cold War and we're fighting for chess pieces and so you want one more nation to be in the Western NATO alliance and one fewer to be in the Warsaw Pact alliance, then be careful what you wish for, because the Ukraine is a liability. It's not an asset. And be careful when you try to revive the tactics of the Cold War, but now deploy a military, orchestrating a military response against the Russians, who are more than capable of bloodying America to the point that the nation no longer survives. This is brinkmanship with everything at stake.
Very much so. Yeah, it sure begs the question, of whether or not, obviously, what the U.S. is doing isn't, or what the erstwhile leaders of the U.S. are doing, isn't really in the interest of the United States of America.
No.
So the question is, qui bono, who benefits?
I'm to the conclusion that there's only, well, no one can benefit. I mean, there is no benefit for any country for what America is instigating in the Ukraine. There is no way that the people on this planet can benefit in any way from what the United States is orchestrating. But I will tell you that there are individuals who think that they will benefit in the short term. And that is, NATO thinks that it will benefit because it's gone from having no mission to a mission. It gets to go play war. The U.S. military gets to benefit because they have done nothing that has been useful in decades, and all of a sudden now they have an enemy that their military has been specifically designed to fight. The president and Congress all of a sudden get locked into the positions because as a wartime country, they are immune from criticism and they are empowered, and they have the opportunity to etch their names in the history of great presidents during wartime. And of course, then there is the merchants of death, the international bankers, particularly those that make money on debt, that would prosper if there is war. And then there's the manufacturers of all of the weapons of war. There are some people that would prosper, but they're not ordinary folks like you and me.